Chapter 2. The Boy Who Would Be King. A False God's Name. The Impossible City. The boy who would be king held his father's skull in his hands. He turned it slowly, running his fingertips across the contours of skinless bone. A thumb, still browned with field dirt, traced across the blunt ivory pegs of the gap-toothed death smile. He lifted his eyes to the stone shelf where the other skulls sat in silent vigil. They stared into the hut's gloomy confines, their eyes replaced by smooth stones, their faces restored with the crude artistry of clay. It was the boy's place to remake his father's face in the same way, sculpting the familiar features with wet mud and slow swipes of a flint knife, then letting the skull bake dry in the high sun. The boy thought he might use seashells for the eyes, if he could barter with the coastal traders for two that were smooth enough. He would do this soon. Such things were tradition. First, he needed answers. He turned the skull once more, circling his thumb around the ragged hole broken into the bone. He didn't need to close his eyes and meditate to know the truth. He didn't need to pray for his father's spirit to tell him what happened. He simply touched the hole in his father's head, and at once he knew. He saw the fall of the bronze knife from behind. He saw his father fall into the mud. He saw everything that had happened leading to this moment in time. The boy who would be king rose from the floor of his family's hut and walked out into the settlement, his father's skull clutched in one hand. Mudbrick huts lined both sides of the river. The wheat fields to the east were a patchwork sea of dark gold beneath the eye of the setting sun. The village was never truly quiet, even after the day's work was done. Families talked and laughed and fought. Dogs barked for attention and whined for food. The wind set the scrubland trees to singing, with the hiss of leaves and the creak of branches forming their eternal song. A ragged dog growled as the boy passed, yet fled yelping when he gave it no more than a glance. A carrion bird, hunchbacked and evil of eye, cried out above the village. A pack of other ragged children moved aside when he drew near, their ball game fading away and their eyes lowering. His barefooted walk took him unerringly to the home of his father's brother. The man, darkened and hardened by his years in the fields, was sat outside the mudbrick hut, threading beads onto a string for his youngest daughter. The boy's uncle uttered the sound that meant the boy's name. In response to this greeting, the boy held up his father's skull. Many centuries after these events, citizens of even civilized and advanced cultures would often misunderstand exactly what a myocardial infarction was. The savage, constricting pain in the chest was due to blood no longer flowing cleanly through the heart's passages, causing harm to the myocardium tissue of the heart itself. Put simply, the core of a human being runs dry, trying to function with no oxygenated lubricant. This happened to the boy's uncle when he set eyes upon the skull of his murdered brother. The boy who would be king watched with neither remorse nor any particular hostility. He looked on as his uncle slid from his crouch onto the mud, clutching at his treacherous chest. He watched as his uncle's sun-darkened features pinched closed, ugly and tight in supreme agony, as the older man shook with the onset of convulsions. He saw the necklace slip from his uncle's grip, the necklace that was being made for his young cousin, and would now never be finished. Others came running. They shouted, they cried. They made the noises of language that spoke of panic and sorrow in a Proto-Indo-European tongue that would come to be known as an early precursor to the Hittite dialect. The boy walked away, heading back towards his family's hut. On the way, he turned to the figure, the giant, clad in gold, who walked nearby. Nordafrik wore clan tattoos curled on the towering warrior's face, curling from his temples to follow the curves of his cheekbones. The serpentine ink curves, white against his dark flesh, ended upon his chin, just beneath his mouth. "Hello, Ra," the boy said in a tongue that wouldn't be spoken on this world for many thousands of years. The language was called High Gothic by those who had come to speak it. The golden warrior, Ra, went to one knee, dazed at the sight of a terror that hadn't existed for millennia, a clean and fertile place still untouched by war. This world wasn't really terror at all. It was still Earth. With the giant kneeling and the boy standing before him, it was far easier to meet each other's eyes.
"My emperor," said the custodian.
The boy rested a hand on the giant's chest plate, the fingers dark against the royal eagle. The boy's farm-worked palm, already rough despite his youth, ran along one golden wing. His expression was reflective, if not entirely serene. He didn't smile. The man that this boy would become never smiled either.
"You have never shown me this memory before," Ra said.
The boy stared at him.
"No, I have not. This is where it all began, Ra. Here, on the banks of the Sakarya River."
The boy turned his old eyes to the river itself.
"So much water. So much life. If I have been disappointed by the galaxy's wonders, it is only because we were fortunate enough to grow in such a cradle. There was so much to learn, Ra, so much to know. It pleases me for you to see what it once was."
Ra couldn't help but smile at the boy's distracted, contemplative tone. He had heard it many times before, in another man's voice, as familiar to him as his own.
"I'm honored to see it, sire."
The boy looked at him, through him, and finally lifted his hand from the eagle sigil upon the custodian's breastplate.
"I sense you have suffered a grave defeat. I cannot reach Kadai or Jasak."
"Kadai is 3 days dead, my king. Jasak fell 2 weeks before him. I am the last tribune."
The boy stared, unblinking. Ra noted the suggestion of a wince. The boy flinched at some unknowable pain.
"Sire?"
the custodian pressed.
"The forces unleashed in the wake of Magnus's misjudgment grow stronger. First a trickle, then a tide. Now a storm's wind, unremitting, unceasing."
"You will hold them back, sir."
"My loyal custodian."
The boy wheezed, soft and slow, his throat giving a tuberculosis rattle. For a moment his eyes unfocused. Blood ran from his nose, lining the curve of his lips.
"Sire, are you wounded?"
The boy's eyes cleared. He wiped the blood away on the back of his dirty hand.
"No. I sense a new presence within the etheric pressure. Something old, so very old, drawing nearer."
Ra waited for an explanation, but the boy didn't elaborate.
"You must do something for me, Ra."
"Anything, my king."
"You must take word to Genetia Kroll. Tell her..."
The boy hesitated, taking a breath.
"Tell her it is time to enact the unspoken sanction."
"It will be as you command, sir."
The words meant nothing to Ra. Once more, he waited for elaboration. Once more, he was denied.
"How did Kadai die?"
the child asked.
"The outward tunnels are falling, my king. Kadai had advanced far from the impossible city when the horde struck. I tried to reach his vanguard to aid their withdrawal."
Ra exhaled softly.
"Forgive me, sire, I tried."
"What of the enemy in the outward tunnels?"
"Traitors from the Legiones Astartes have joined the Neverborn. The Eaters of Worlds, the Bearers of the Word, the Sons of Horus. Our outriders have witnessed titans in the mist, and entities the size of titans. They flood the main arterials and secondary capillaries.
Unimaginable thoughts dawned and died behind the child's dark eyes.
It was inevitable. We knew they would gain access to the webway before the war's end. You have Ignatum with you, Ra. You have the Scion of Vigilant Light.
You will hold.
I am withdrawing all remaining forces to the Impossible City. The outward tunnels are lost, my king. Overwhelmed beyond retaking.
So be it, the child allowed.
Make a stand at Calistar.
Sell every step as dearly as you are able.
Is there more?
I am sending Diocletian to the surface to requisition more warriors. Whatever he can muster. My king, the 10,000 bleeds, and the Silent Sisterhood bleeds with us. But if you could leave the throne for even a brief time, sire, we could press deep back into Magnus's folly. We could cleanse hundreds of tunnels.
I cannot leave the Golden Throne, said the boy, curt, sharp. That will not change.
Sire, I cannot leave the Golden Throne.
Every route between the Imperial Dungeon and the Impossible City would shatter and flood with Warpborn. You would be alone, Ra. Alone and surrounded.
But we could hold until you reached us.
Kadai made the same demand, as did Jessak and Helios before him. Each one of the 10,000 represents genetic lore acquired over many lifetimes. Each one of you is unique. A work of art never to be repeated. I am miserly with your lives when I spend so many others without a thought. I would not order the 10,000 into the fire if there was another way.
I understand, sire.
No, you do not. The boy closed his eyes. The moment I rise from my place here, mankind's dreams will die.
As you say, my king. The boy held a hand across his face, cradling his pained features.
What of the Mechanicum's work? What of Mendel?
The Ad Nector Primus is dead, sire. He fell when the outward tunnels began to collapse.
The boy met Ra's stare, dark-eyed and cold.
Mendel has fallen.
At a nexus junction in one of the primary arterials. He was part of Kadai's vanguard. I fought my way through to recover his remains.
The boy's eyes lost their focus. It was like looking at the shell of a child, the preserved cadaver of a boy lost too young.
My king,
Ra pressed.
This is your war, said the distracted boy. The 10,000 and the Silent Sisterhood must hold the webway. If you fail me, you fail humanity.
I will die before I fail you, Highness.
Again the boy winced, a cringe this time. The revelation of pain, fearless but true, flashed in the child's eyes. It drew him back to the present.
Malkador and the Seventh are losing the war for the Imperium, he said. That is a tragedy. But it is a tragedy that can be undone as long as I draw breath. The Imperium is ultimately just an empire. Empires can be reconquered, whether saved from ignorance or pulled back from the clutches of traitors.
Ra's grin was a crescent of weary misery.
We face a great many traitors, my king.
The edges of the boy's mouth deepened. Not a smile, never that. A twitch, perhaps. Another wince.
There are always traitors, Ra. After the 10,000 performed the Asherik silencing, I told you all that there was one sin far graver than betrayal.
Failure.
Failure, the boy concurred. That holds true now, just as it did then. Just as it always has. You cannot fail here, Ra. This is the war for humanity's soul. The webway is its battleground.
Ra said nothing, for no words would do. He turned to look at this paradise of primitive humanity, with their mud huts and their fields and their weaponless hands. Such innocence, such unbelievable, terrifying innocence.
The 16th sails for Terra to crown itself king, said the boy. Can you imagine if I allowed that to happen? A weapon held in the wrong hands, installing itself as the lord of a whole species. Terra would be in ashes before the first sunrise.
Ra swallowed at the sudden chill in the child's words.
Sire, are you well?
The boy cast a slow gaze across their surroundings, across the rows of tall crops, around the village where every other man, woman, and child was ignoring them as though they no longer existed.
This is where I spent my youth, working the soil and bringing life from the ground.
The custodian inclined his head, causing the servos in his collar to purr.
I have given you my report, sire. Why do you keep me here?
So I may illuminate you, the boy replied,
speaking with a patience that bordered upon the preternatural.
You watched that man die, did you not?
Ra looked back over his shoulder where the village folk were gathered around the fallen man, weeping and comforting in a loose, unwashed herd.
I did.
That was my uncle, my father's brother.
You killed him, the custodian said without judgment.
Yes. He struck my father from behind with a piece of sharpened bronze, too poorly made to even be called a knife.
Men had killed one another for generations before my birth. But this was the first slaying that had resonance to me, that changed my existence. It was illuminating. He paused for a moment, following Ra's gaze back to the noisy villagers.
The very first murder was also a fratricide, he said without emotion. Thousands of years before this, when men and women still owed as much to apes as to the form we now know. But it is curious to me. Brothers have always killed brothers. I wonder why that is. Some evolutionary flaw, some ingrained emotional fragility written into mankind's core, perhaps.
Ra shook his head.
I have no way of knowing the emotions at hand, sire. I have no brothers.
I was being rhetorical, Ra.
The boy took a breath.
This night was significant not for the murder, but for the deliverance of justice.
For my uncle's deed, I stopped his heart's function and forced him to die. In eras to come, this will be called the Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation, or more simply, an eye for an eye. It is justice itself. Hundreds of human cultures through time will embrace it. Some will do so out of brutality, others from ideals that they believe to be fair and enlightened. But it is a precept that runs through the marrow of our species. Ra pulled his gaze away from the weeping humans. He heard his sire's words. He knew the history and philosophy behind them, but the reason for them yet eluded him. His doubt plainly showed on his face, for the boy inclined his head in recognition.
I told you that this is where it all began, the boy said.
Culture, the warrior replied. Civilization.
The boy's momentary silence told Ra that he had guessed wrong.
We are not far removed from those beginnings, Ra, either in distance or time. You could walk to the cradle of civilization from here, where men and women made the very first city. When I leave this village, that is where I will go. That journey is coming soon. But no, that is not what I mean when I speak of beginnings.
The boy turned the skull over in his hands, just as he had done in the hut before.
This is where I first learned the truth behind our species. This very eve, as I held my father's skull and considered how to restore his features according to our burial rites, when I learned of his murder, it was a revelation into the heart of all of mankind. This is a world that has no need of you yet, Ra. It has no need for imperial bodyguards. for it is a world that knows nothing of emperors or warlords or conquerors, and therefore it knows nothing of unity, nothing of law.
You speak of leadership,
the custodian said. Not quite. Every village already had leaders. Every family had patriarchs and matriarchs. I speak of kings, givers of law, rulers of cultures. Not merely those who give orders, but those whose decisions keep a civilization bound together. This was the night I realized that mankind must be ruled. He could not be trusted to thrive without a master. It needed to be guided and shaped, bound by laws and set to follow the course laid by its wisest minds. Ra breathed in the humid air of a land that knew nothing of the ravages it would suffer in the centuries to come. He smelled the sweat of the workers and the minerals in the river water, feeling his blood sing at the sensation of a truly unspoiled world. He didn't admire the crudeness of a people that lacked all but the rudiments of technology, but he felt awed at the species' humble genesis. To think that the Emperor, revered above all, had risen from such beginnings. He looked the boy in the eyes, meeting that dark and knowing gaze, and spoke with a suspicion that curled the War Clan tattoos on his cheeks into a slight smile. Did this truly happen, sire? Were you really born here? The boy who would be king turned the skull over in his hands, his voice already distant with distraction. I shall barter with the coastal traders that come at the high moon. I will use shells for my father's eyes. My king? The boy turned to him and spoke in the voice of the monarch he would one day become. He touched his fingertips to the custodian's forehead, delivering a jolt of force. Awaken, Ra. Ra opened his eyes. He hadn't slept. He had merely blinked. A half-second span, within which he saw back to the Emperor's childhood in a time of almost primeval purity. He exhaled slowly as his senses returned to the here and now, among the monuments of a dead empire within the necropolis of Kalistar. The Eldar Cathedral was silent around him. Its shattered dome let in the realm's ceaseless, sourceless light, casting shadows at inconsistent angles and reflecting oddly against the custodian's golden armour. Something like mist clung to the ground with a greasy tenacity, whispering when disturbed by the tread of intruders. And they were intruders here. Of that there was no doubt. A statue of an alien maiden stared down at Ra as he trained. She stood in silent reverence, her streaming robes and features sculpted from the same pillar of song-spun wraithbone. One of her slender hands was outstretched in pleading benediction. The other rested, palm against her chest, perhaps warding away some unknowable heartache, perhaps simply conveying some alien torment that had once mattered to her worthless dying species. The spear in his hands, gifted to him by the Emperor, cast slashing silver reflections against the cathedral's walls. Its blade showed the scratches and scrapes of endless use with the perfection of ceaseless repair. He ran his fingertips along the flat visage of his own reflection in its mirrored surface, seeing the unmasked image he so rarely presented to the world. Unease prickled at his flesh beneath the gold warplate. He felt the weariness of the last 5 years clinging to him, the way cold wind slows the bones. Exhaustion wasn't alien to the warriors of the 10,000. Their strength lay in enduring pain and weariness, not banishing it. But he felt as he had in his initiate days, when the trials had seen him drained of blood by the Emperor's Vita Fertum machines, before subjecting him to the rigors of custodian training. Disgusted with himself at his failure of focus, Ra resumed the sparring briefly interrupted by the Emperor. His spear spun and whirled, singing its bladed song in the cold air. He lashed out with fist, boot, and elbow, losing himself in the harmony of emptying his mind of all else.
Ra moved before the altar, forcing his muscles through the motions of the 50 forms, seeking the absolute focus that came through the alignment of body and mind. He shut out his surroundings, paying no heed to the pillared cathedral or the great altar, banishing the sound of his snarling armor joints and the thudding of his boots on the cracked wraithbone floor. Soon he was perspiring freely, rivulets of sweat painting his dark features, following the lines of his cheekbones and the tattoos that snaked from his temples to the edges of his mouth. His spear whistled and whined, cutting the misty air. Its high-pitched slicing passage joined the melody of his heaving breaths. Midway through the third form, the whirling spear slipped in his grip. The hesitation was minuscule, a fractional shift of the haft in his clutches, invisible to the observing eye. Ra clenched his teeth, leaning harder into the movements, chasing the elusive serenity. He thought back to the Emperor's words, spoken in the memory dream of where the Master of Mankind had first risen among the fields and mud huts. Words of promise, of responsibility, the necessary command of humanity to bring about law and progress. He thought of his own words to Diocletian and Kyria before sending them to the surface. Scarcely one in 10 of the 10,000 remain here. He thought of... The spear slipped a second time. Ra tightened his grip before the blade could fall from his hands, but the damage was done. He stilled in his movements, breathing heavily. The stone alien maiden still stared down at him, imploring without meaning. He turned from her, looking up through the shattered dome ceiling. With no sun, there was no day. With no sky, there was no night. The impossible city, none of its defenders used the Eldar name except in amused derision, stretched on for kilometres in every direction. In every direction. To look to the east and the west was to see a cityscape of winding streets and crumbling towers rising at unbelievable angles, as though the ground curved in the shape of an unimaginably vast conduit. To look directly up was to see yet more districts of the ancient Wraithbone City, kilometres distant and difficult to perceive through the realm's haze of mist. Those tall towers of smoothly curving alien architecture reached down just as the spires on the ground reached up. In truth, once a traveller approached the city, there was no way of knowing where the true ground was. Gravity was unchanged no matter where one walked. None of the Mechanicum's instruments could explain the phenomena, but precious few Martian instruments had worked reliably in this realm since first entering it years before. It was here that the Primarch Magnus had led an ocean of demons in his wake, in his quest to warn the Emperor of Horus's treachery. And it was here, with the naivety of a proud and wayward godchild, that Magnus had set a sword to the throat of the Emperor's dreams. The catacombs of Kalastar led directly to the Imperial dungeon. If the impossible city fell, terror fell with it. No one knew what cataclysm had ravaged Kalastar in epochs past. Whatever had driven the Eldar from the impossible city was a mystery that the Imperial vanguard had no capacity to solve. Much of Kalastar's core was a labyrinth of Mechanicum-born sections bolted into place, bridging the divide between the Imperial dungeon and the dead hub city itself. Great spans of tunnels, bridges, and channels, forged by the blood, sweat, and oil of countless priests in their Mechanicum's sacred red. How the Emperor had first conceived this inconceivable project was a similar mystery. But the Mechanicum's greatest minds had followed the many hundreds of pages in each exacting schemata, nevertheless. In reverence of his vision, a new caste of tech priest had risen unseen by Terran and Martian eyes alike, the Ad Nector Concilium, the Unifiers. And they had done it. They had bound Terran steel and Martian iron to avenues of senseless, unnatural materials previously shaped by long-dead, long-forgotten alien overlords. They had unified physical machinery with the psychically resonant matter of another dimension, and rebuilt the heart of an alien city. The impossible city was a gateway to the webway beyond. At its borders, the web began. Thousands of capillary tunnels and great thoroughfares worming through the ancient alien network, leading to other worlds and regions in the galaxy. Every junction, every tunnel, every bridge, every passage leading out of the city, whether too small for anything but a lone human or vast enough for a battle titan, was held secure by entrenched Mechanicum thrall warriors, oblivion knights of the Sisters of Silence, and the Emperor's own custodians. Kalistar was not made up of roads and sectors, as the human mind would contextualize urban order, but was formed into winding pathways across plateaus and rises, all leading to apex structures of presumably great import. Each bridge spanned a stretch of infinite abyss. The Mechanicum's seers had reported that anyone falling from the bridges of Kalistar would die of old age before reaching the bottom. Looking down into the nothingness, one could easily believe it. A great spire rose highest of all in this district. The long promenades on the rising approach to it, lined with eroded statues of what were initially believed to be Eldar heroes.
Gods, Diocletian had said half a decade before,
bluntly correcting the Mechanicum overseer responsible for the initial scouting probes. A hololithic map had cast flickering half-light across his features at the time.
I have studied their profane and foolish lore. These are not merely statues of heroes. Many of them are depictions of the aliens' false gods.
And so it was named the Godspire. Tribune Endymion and the Soulless Queen now used it as a command center. The approach was once a scene of stunning, if alien, beauty. An Eldar traveller, in the time of that star-spanning empire's glory, would have made a long, sloping ascent through gardens of luminescent singing crystals, across arcing bridges that curved over the bottomless void between tier platforms, before standing at the gates that led into the tower at the city's heart. Now the crystal formations were melted remains on their floating pedestals, many supporting the weight of automated tarantula gun batteries. Most of the bridges were broken, their spans long since fallen into the nothingness below the impossible city. The courtyards, once open expanses, housed a bustling hive of Mechanicum arming stations, supply depots, prefab barracks, and landing pads. In the cathedral, Ra levelled his gaze at the statue of the alien goddess maiden once more. A filthy creature, forever staring with her slanted eyes. Who was she to judge the species that fought this new war in the ruins of her city? Her time, and the time of her people, was over. The Eldar had been weighed by the implacable whims of the universe, and they had been found wanting. His spear began its singing spin. The first blow shattered her reaching hand, sending sundered wraithbone clattering against the floor. The second cleaved through the goddess's neck, toppling her hooded head to the floor with an echoing ring. A great crack, lightning bolted across her pale features from forehead to throat. Her severed neck steamed from the vicious kiss of the spear's power field.
A fit of temper?
Came a gentle voice from the temple's entrance. Ra turned slowly, irritated that he'd not sensed his visitor's approach. Truly, his humours were more unbalanced than he had realised, if it was so easy to enter his presence undetected. A woman and a girl. He hadn't expected them so soon.
Not quite, he admitted. I disliked how the alien stared at me.
He braced himself as they took the last few steps, resisting a hissed intake of breath at the pressure squeezing its cold fingers inside his skull.
Commander,
Ra greeted the first figure, and Melpomene, he greeted the second. The commander of the Silent Sisterhood had come accompanied by her aide, a girl child of 9 or 10 years, her head shaved bare and marked with Aquila tattoos, clad in a simple adept's robe of white, and beribboned with trailing parchments, listing observances and rites that Ra had no desire to know of. He immediately looked away from the soulless child. The sister commander was bad enough alone, but these two together threatened to steal all hope of concentration. Breaking eye contact helped, barely. Kroll's presence was even harder to tolerate, yet impossible to dismiss. She was a tall figure, clad in contoured silver plate and cloaked in the grey-brown fur of some great off-world beast. It was a struggle for Ra to fix his attention on her, yet difficult to concentrate on anything else. She ate at his thoughts, the way the night eats light, dulling and dimming everything else around her. The sensation was far from pleasant. She pulled at the custodian's focus, not because she outshone everything else, but because she drowned and eclipsed it. To stand near her was to be near something hollow, something starving, something that sucked at the inside of Ra's skull. She was empty, nothing in the form of something, a void masquerading as a presence. Genetia Kroll greeted Ra with a nod, her eyes gently closing for the gesture. Her mouth remained hidden behind a great silver mouthpiece, surgically bound to her jaw and cheekbones. As she dipped her head, her high crest of red-dyed hair swayed gently. Ra knew of that ritual. The Sisters of Silence never cut their hair from the moment they took the Oath of Tranquility. Kroll's mane, even bound at the roots into a topknot, was long enough to reach the base of her spine. If anyone could ever be in doubt as to her authority, were the evidence of their senses somehow not enough, all lingering misunderstandings would be banished by the Zweihander sword Veracity sheathed along her cloak, its hilt and grip showing over her shoulder. The lord of an entire species had once wielded that blade, before making a gift of it to the maiden who now bore it on her back.
"Greetings, Ra Endymion,"
said the child at the sister commander's side. Her voice was a delicate lilt, at odds with the armoured warrior maiden towering above her. Genetia kept her sharp, dark eyes on the custodians. She lifted one hand, performing an artful series of gestures with her gauntleted fingers in the air before her chest plate. The girl child spoke for her mistress, staring just as brazenly as the older woman.
"You have received word from the Emperor."
There was no accusation in Melpomene's tone, nor in Genetia's stare. An accusation would imply the possibility of doubt. "I have," admitted Ra. He didn't bother to ask how Genetia knew. Genetia signed her reply, her dark eyes fierce, but her gloved hand moving patiently and slowly. Many of the 10,000 no longer required their silent sister allies to employ the signs and gestures of Thoughtmark at all, having fought at their sides for years and learnt to interpret their moods and meanings from even the slightest movements or facial changes. However, no one could claim that degree of familiarity with Commander Kroll. Necessity demanded that Melpomene remain a constant presence at her side. Something in Kroll's appearance slid greasily from the senses, refusing to remain in his mind. He would be looking directly at her, watching her hands move in patterns he knew as well as any spoken language, yet sense and meaning came in fragments, as though he were hearing the barest scraps of any conversation.
"The withdrawal proceeds apace,"
translated the bald girl.
"All forces are en route to the impossible city."
"He was so weary, Genetia. I fear news of our failure only added to his burdens."
"The failure was Kadai's,"
replied the girl child, watching her mistress's hands.
"Not yours. Not mine. Kadai reached too far, with too much pride, against your counsel and my wishes. Regardless, even Kadai could not have known of the hordes infesting the outward tunnels."
Ra found precious little reassurance in that, no matter how true it might be. Kroll noticed his reluctance.
"You and I will hold this vile city until it falls, Tribune. And when it does, we will go back to fighting tunnel by tunnel, as we did when we were first ordered into the web. There is no other choice."
Ra nodded and said nothing. There was nothing to say. Defeat was inconceivable.
What are our master's wishes?
The child asked. Ra forced the tension from his muscles, his armor joints murmuring at the subtle change in demeanor.
He commanded me to tell you that you must enact what he referred to as the unspoken sanction.
Kroll's pupils were pinpricks in the alien light.
He said this?
Asked the young girl.
You are truly certain?
Ra knew better than to ask what the command might mean. The sisters were an order apart. They had their secrets, just as the 10,000 had theirs. Such was the Emperor's will. Ra met the sister commander's eyes. Sensing his sincerity, Kroll nodded and signed a reply.
Sister Kyria Kasrin will accompany Diocletian on his return to the surface, said the young girl, in order to enact the Emperor's command.
As you wish, Ra agreed.
Genetia followed this with a question, her eyes darkly urgent.
Will he join us?
Melpomene asked.
He remains bound to the Golden Throne. The forces besieging him outside the Webway are growing in strength. He won't stand with us.
Melpomene watched her mistress's hands with a distant gaze, her mouth moving all the while.
What he commands, we will enforce.
As she finished signing, Genetia shifted once more. Rather than gesture a full sentence, she merely reached up over her shoulder, close to the back of her neck, and tapped her fingertips to Veracity's long grip. It was enough for the child to translate.
Is the Emperor well?
The pressure torments him, but he remains resolute. Beyond the assault against his psychic defences, he spoke of a new presence drawing near. Something old. Something already in the Webway.
Genetia cut him off with a gentle wave of her hand. The motion moved seamlessly into more sign language.
That is why I am here,
said Melpomene.
If you have finished your meditations, will you please come with me?
As you wish.
The custodian followed as the commander strode from the cathedral. Together they looked across the mist-wreathed vista of Kalistar, as the impossible city stretched before them, around them, above them. Gone were the times such an insane view triggered disorientation in even Ra's enhanced senses. Now, when he looked at the Eldar ruins, he saw a bastion of mechanicum-armoured and gun-platformed towers and bridges that would be infinitely easier to defend than several hundred separate tunnels, but with no margin for error. Withdrawing to the city itself meant losing any fallback point. The entire city was an unlikely hybrid of Imperial technology grafted onto time-eaten Eldar wraithbone. When it came to the impossible city, Ra's awe had long ago been replaced by cold calculation and concerns of logistics. And there stood the Godspire, where a golden stormbird swinging into land was silhouetted by the mist of middle distance. Three propellered Mechanicum ornithopters flapped in a slow arc above the landing gunship. The Kolo-Borinkos flyers were mercifully silent at this distance. Up close, the machine's flapping wings and spinning rotors gave off a brutal roar. Scarcely even a quarter of the Godspire's height, yet standing as a colossus above the marshalling Mechanicum forces, was the Scion of Vigilant Light. Freshly returned from one of the widest and tallest tunnels, the Warlord Titan was crawling with repair crews and maintenance servitors, who swarmed over its armor plating like ants clustering over a kill.
Are you troubled? Ra asked the sister commander. I cannot read your expressions.
Genetia Kroll elaborated with several gestures for the girl to speak aloud.
Have you heard the reports of thoroughfare HG245-1212?
Ra nodded, paying heed to the background murmur of the dimmed Vox reports playing at the back of his focus, whispering of the unfolding war. Fighters at the barricades fighting, falling, launching counterattacks, the endless cycle. He had dulled them to near mute while sparring and meditating upon the Emperor's will, yet he knew at once of which report the sister commander spoke.
I have already requested the Mechanicum send one of the Uridia caste patrols,
Melpomene qualified.
They are less efficient since Adnector Primus Mendel was slain, but they assured me it would be done. Now you tell me the Emperor himself has sensed this being's approach. A protector and its war machines may not be enough. What would be powerful enough alone for the Emperor to sense? What could be out there?
There are a million things out there, Ra replied. Each more impossible than the last.
Genetia Kroll signed her reply slowly and very clearly.
This,
said Melpomene,
is something different.
She hesitated then, almost awkward as she signed once more.
May I ask what form the Emperor's message took?
Ra found the concept of what he'd seen, that pure and ancient world, difficult to frame in simple words. Genetia noted his hesitation and stared, intrigued.
He showed me his childhood, the custodian admitted, and told me of the moment he first learned that humanity needed rulers.
It was gratifying in a way to see Sister Commander Genetia Kroll, the soulless queen of the Imperium, show genuine shock. As much as Ra felt discomfort at the sight, it was still a revelation to witness. Her hands hesitated in the air before her breastplate, before moving into another series of smooth signs.
His childhood,
the young girl said.
Elaborate, please, custodian.
Ra felt the cold of Kroll's fierce adamance.
I saw Terra. More accurately, perhaps, I saw old Earth.
Neither Kadai nor Jasarek ever spoke of receiving such a vision. The future, the present, the recent past, yes, all of those. Never a reflection of old Earth.
I saw what I saw.
Yet why would he show you this?
The girl asked, her neutral tone conveying none of Genetia's mute amazement.
You ask a stone why the wind blows, Commander. I don't know.
I must think on this. Thank you, Custodian.
The Sister Commander clicked her fingers, beckoning the girl, and offered Ra a polite bow of farewell. He didn't return it. He bowed and knelt only to one man. He did, however, force a weary smile to Melpomene, aping the pleasant expression in an attempt to be disarming. For the first time, Melpomene spoke without her mistress signing.
You look monstrous when you pretend to be human, said the little girl.
Ra kept smiling.
As do you, soulless one.